Hello, and welcome to another episode of Shipping and Handling. I'm your host, Jennifer Eden.
And I'm your co-host, Bridget Smith.
I'd like to celebrate the fact that Bridget should sound normal this week, because we learned that one of the reasons you could never hear her is because she's too tall for the microphone stands.
So I am going to move it over. Underneath.
We put a book underneath. It is the second book in the Heartland trilogy by Chuck Wendig called Blightborn, and it is just the right length to stand this microphone up.
It's quite long.
To face level. It's also a really good series. So this week, since it is finally, human temperature
hot
outside in New York.
We've sort of passed human temperature.
We've passed human temperature and gone straight into summer. And I know that we're all going to be regretting celebrating that it's not cold anymore in about 2 weeks. But for now, it feels like summer. So we thought we would discuss summer reading and the various permutations thereof. And I'm sure many of you listening had summer reading when you were a kid.
Yes.
So what was your favorite book that you were ever assigned?
I was assigned?
Well, what was your general feeling towards summer reading?
My general feeling towards summer reading was that I was always happy to read books in the summer, and I almost never wanted to read the books that were assigned. So when I was in, elementary school, middle school, there was sort of a list all the books you read over the summer, or like, list three books that you read over the summer, and I was like filling up sheets of paper. Look at all these books I read. This was so much fun.
Yeah.
And then I got into high school, and they were like, read these epic classic novels, and I was like,
I would have to. I would rather do literally anything else. Yeah, I have really fond memories of the sort of summer reading challenges, but somehow I don't really ever remember them being assigned for school. I remember that our local library. We had this little rinky-dink community library that was actually really good and had a really good children's section, and they had like a summer challenge thing where you like, I think that there was a prize you won at the end of the summer.
We had that too. I don't think I actually did that, but
yeah. Oh, I was intensely competitive, so I did it every year. And there's always one fucking kid that read more than me. I was like, ugh. Don't you know I'm the best reader? But how?
I also sometimes got mad when the long books that I was reading counted for exactly the same as like the 50-page books.
But it's so long. Yeah. No, I feel that all the time. Like when I finished Dreadnought, I was like, that's at least three YA novels. At least. Probably more. Come on.
Come on, Goodreads. Count it that way.
It should be weighted. The stats should be weighted. But I actually, funnily enough, so in high school, when I was a freshman in high school, we actually had a really good summer reading list, and one of the books that we were assigned was Ender's Game.
Oh.
And cool. Of course, by the time I actually got to freshman English, the teacher had been replaced, but she was like, you were all assigned to read this stuff, so I sort of read it, and we had like a really nice discussion about it. But yeah, Ender's Game was an assigned summer.
That's cool.
Reading.
I believe that going into ninth grade, I was assigned Great Expectations and Maya Tania.
You should
not be giving Great Expectations to 13-year-olds to read, because my dad read it at the same time and he loved it, and I was like, I could not hate this book more.
This book is stupid. Everyone's doing dumb things. I like Willa Cather, but like, at 13.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sort of two minds about the whole like assigned reading thing, because on the one hand, it does make people hate literature, but on the other hand, it doesn't make everybody hate literature. I mean, I knew many people that like really looked forward to getting those. Because like they're not necessarily the things that you would choose to read yourself.
Yes.
Like, I don't know anyone who would have picked Willa Cather at 13 or 14 years old.
No.
To like, it was Willa Cather, right?
Yes.
Okay. I was like, nah. Like last week when I made a complete ass of myself, like, attributing the wrong place of origin to the Peter Grant narrative. I was like, oh God, I'm such a jerk. I know a lot of people who really got a lot out of the summer reading thing, but
yeah, I distinctly remember reading A Tale of Two Cities, which I had tried when I was in sixth grade because I was extremely ambitious, and just couldn't get like 50 pages into it because, I was 10.
Yeah.
I was trying really hard, but I just couldn't figure it out, and going into 10th grade when we were assigned A Tale of Two Cities, I sort of had the same thing where I struggled through the first 50 pages, kept struggling, and then it sort of ignited.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, it's like, this book is amazing.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, maybe I don't hate Dickens.
For me, the book that made me not hate Dickens was Bleak House. Was it Bleak House? I think it was Bleak House my freshman year.
Oh, we were also assigned one of the summer reading books that we
freshman
had.
College.
Oh, okay.
So it's fine. Yeah, no, they did not force Bleak House on us in high school.
I mean, I'm not really surprised, judging by some of the things that were forced on me. But another one of the summer reading ones that I'm glad that I had was God of Small Things by Arundhati Roy.
Oh, yeah.
Which I really liked. It was it was sort of a weird experience reading it. It's a little bit of a weird book, but it was really good, and I was glad that it was both enjoyable and interesting to read, which is pretty much all you can expect for the best you can expect from a signed reading.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I feel like these days teachers and librarians are so much cooler because there's so much more that, you know, you can, I feel like you could do a really cool assignment where you could be like, you know, here's a classic, you know, here's a classic thing, and here's like three modern books that are inspired by that thing. And, you know, you could really read the classic thing and then the three other things that could be like your summer assignment. And then you could write an essay about it.
Yeah.
Free curriculum idea, teachers. Well, if given your druthers, what do you like reading during the summer? Because I know there's the cliche about sort of like, it's a beach read, you know. Murder and sex, and you read it on the beach, and then you leave it behind in your hotel and forget about it.
I tend to like really sort of dreamy things in the summer. I don't really, occasionally I go for those sort of fast-paced, easy things to read, but the last couple of years I've gone on vacation with my family and just brought these huge epic novels that I'm not going to have any time to read the rest of the time.
Yeah.
So, like, 2 years ago I brought Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, because when am I going to have time to sit down and really sink into a 1,000-page Regency novel other than on vacation, sitting on the deck of this house, overlooking the lake, sitting in the sun, reading about magicians. Mm. So that was fun. But the quintessential one for me is Dandelion Wine by Ray Bradbury.
Mm.
That pretty much epitomizes what I am looking for, or what I like in a summer novel. Where it's very much about summer and it's about the experience of summer, but it's sort of dreamy and weird. And I reread it. We were assigned, that was again an assigned book in sixth grade, and I loved it then. I read it again in college over the summer just to see if it stood up, and it really did. Exactly as
Ray Bradbury, he knows what he's doing. Yeah. That Ray, he's gonna go far.
He's got talent.
He's a talented young man. Someone, oh my gosh, I forget who was. I think it was Aliyah Hunt Johnson who was tweeting the other day that she, you know, heard a song come on her Spotify and it was from that promising young group, The Supremes. Was it The Supremes? I think
yes.
It was Supremes.
She was like, oh, I really like this. I wonder where I could hear more. It turns out it's The Supremes.
Yeah, it's like, they're going to go far, that group. So talented. But I think for me, I'm the same way. Like, I tend to bring sort of the big meaty books. But at the same time, like, last summer was when I read, my sister and I read, I'm good, most of the Cassandra Clare books last summer.
Oh, okay.
Last year we went to this cabin in Tennessee for about a week, and I brought like 5 or 6 books, and I think I finished all of them. But they were like, these, but I mean, we literally had nothing else to do.
Yeah.
But like, sit on the deck. My uncle tried to teach me guitar, and I was very bad at it. My uncle was awesome. And we would, like, go for hikes, but most of the time it was reading. So yeah. I read Eleanor Catton's book, The Luminaries. I read a P.D. James, I think. There's a couple of others, but I mean, it was these big sort of meaty things. I remember one summer, I think it was the summer before I went to China, we went to Galveston for a weekend, and I read Our Mutual Friend, you know. Yeah. Last year I read, Michael Chabon, Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay. Okay. Took me a minute.
Yeah, I can't help you there because there's like 6.
Yeah, I read The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay on Jones Beach with my aunt and my sister.
Nice.
So
last year I chose Hild. Hild was my vacation
Hild?
Read.
Hild?
Yes. Nicola Griffith, sort of pre-medieval. It's about this woman who, or I suppose she's a girl for most of it. But she would become St. Hilda of Whitby, but she's basically the king's seer, but she's not actually magic, she's just really smart and very intuitive and able to put things together and sort of predict the way that people are going to act based on her knowledge of them. But to everyone else, it seems supernatural. So she's, it's basically about her sort of running around in, like, was it 14th century Britain, with the king and the king's progress, I guess. It's really interesting to see how I was thinking about this a lot because the king travels around from camp to camp, from castle mm-hmm. to castle, and it's because there are all of these tiny little kingdoms at war with each other, and if he doesn't visit the areas of his kingdom, they start to think that maybe they would be better off elsewhere, and so he's gotta keep circulating around being like, "Hello, I'm here again. I am your king." And so I didn't elect you. And I was like, I would really like to see this in a setting where this is a magical requirement. And I was like, no, I just made up the Merlin conspiracy by Diana Wynne Jones. I have read that book. No wonder I wanted to read it. So, of course, then I had to go home and read the Merlin conspiracy again.
Which I have not read.
It's a weird book. Even by Diana Wynne Jones standards, it's sort of like all over the place and there's a lot of weird stuff going on. And as you're reading it, you're sort of like, this plot is taking so many left turns, I don't really know where any of this is coming circle. From. But it all comes, it does, like a circle, it comes together in the end.
Make enough turns.
All of it comes back in, and I remember I read it the first time, and I liked it because of this whole weird British magical stuff that was going mm-hmm. on, and I liked the way she deals with multiverses. And I was like, this is not a good book, but I like it anyway, and the more I've read it, the more I'm like, okay, it's not a typical book, but I think it is very well constructed. I do think you should read Deep Secret first, even though the Merlin conspiracy is only vaguely in the same vein as it. Mm-hmm. But I think Deep Secret is a better book.
Yeah.
And it was just reprinted by Tor. It was out of print for several years. And
nice.
I was so upset because my copy had been read by me and by so many other people that it was
falling apart.
Yep. And so I'm like, oh, I can buy a new one now.
Yay.
Very exciting.
I saw, I was in Barnes & Noble the other day, because there's a couple of Barnes & Nobles in places that I normally am mm-hmm. on the weekends. There's one up by my church. And so I always go in and check the new sci-fi fantasy shelf. And for some reason, I was in the one on 14th Street the other day, and I was on the new sci-fi shelf. And there was the reprints of Kushiel's Dart, the sort of 50 Shades reprints.
I haven't seen the covers for those.
They're very 50 Shades. They're very sort of like handcuffs. Like, not like handcuffs, but sort of like that kind of feel.
Yeah.
But you said reprints from Tor. I was just like, I think it's a slightly different reprint from Tor.
Yes.
Well, when you were younger, did you ever do the thing where you were like, I'm going to read all of these books this summer?
Oh, yes.
You know, like pick an author and sort of like...
I had a... thing where
or like
I was,
have a project, like a reading project that you assign yourself.
I did. Let me see if I can remember these, because I'm absolutely sure that I did. I was both. I don't think I ever completed any because I was organized. I was ambitious and organized enough to figure out a project, but not organized enough to actually complete it.
Yes.
And no one else cared if I completed it, so I didn't need to prove anything to anyone.
Yeah.
What about you?
All the time. The summer I was a volunteer, one of the books I brought with me was War and Peace, and I technically finished it, but I only read the peace parts. But I was like, I'm going to finish War and Peace. So to this day, I count that I have read it. I skipped everything involving Napoleon. I was just like, skip, skip, skip. So I would like to reread that one of these days. I've been trying to think about, like, because this summer I think I'm going to have a lot of free time. My roommates... got access to a beach house, so like there's a possibility of like a lot of beach time this summer. Although I was thinking like the beach is wasted on me because I do not tan. I burn. I still have.
I go and I put on sunscreen and a cover up, and then also giant straw hat.
Do you see this line?
Yes.
This is the shorts tan I got last summer when I got a sunburn so bad that it took 5 weeks to peel. So yeah, I don't tan.
Yeah.
I was in London looking like I had scabies. My skin was like peeling off. I'm going to have a lot of beach time, and I was thinking that I should, you know, this would be a good year to sort of like, I'm going to turn 30 in the fall. Like, I feel like this would be a good sort of self-improvement-y time, you know, reading stuff I've never read.
I think that my summer project, I took my vacation 2 weeks ago, so I don't have a summer vacation this year. So I think I'm just going to have to spend that time cracking down on manuscripts. I'm still behind, and so I
mean, I'm never gonna not be behind.
I know, but
I've sort of reached a level of resignation.
Point.
I've just reached a level of resignation at this point that I'm never gonna reach inbox zero. I guess that's a worthy That's a worthy summer project.
Yeah, I think it's not that I'm not going to get to Inbox Zero, but I may get to a point where I'm not embarrassed to look at it, I guess. That's my goal.
I can look at my inbox without shame.
I can say where I am up to and not want to cry.
Yeah.
So that's my goal. I'm just going to have to... And the good thing is that reading on a Kindle, I can even do that outside in the sun.
Nice.
So it's not quite the same going to Central Park as it is sitting on a deck overlooking the lake.
Yeah.
With people bringing you drinks. By people, I mean mostly my mother.
Mothers are people. It was just Mother's Day.
I don't have like servants at this lake house. I have my mother going, "You're gonna get dehydrated." You're correct, mother. I will drink some more water.
Oh, so you meant water, not like drinks with umbrellas.
Oh, no, like water or powdered lemonade mixed into water.
That's much less fun.
Yes, this is not fancy.
No, this summer I think I'm just going to try and get through books that I own but have not read.
Yeah.
Except too. I just ordered two, so. Problem.
One of the ones I'm really looking forward to is Bone Gap.
Oh,
I have a copy of it, and I think it's going to be exactly that sort of dreamy, compelling summer read that I really like, and so I'm really looking forward to sort of cracking down with that.
It's funny, you know, Bone Gap was reviewed in the New York Times this weekend, and I ordered another book that was reviewed in the New York Times, Ember in the Ashes, Saba Tahir, because I saw the trailer for it at Age of Ultron, and I was like, this is so cool! Like, went out and pre-ordered it.
That's really cool. I've only seen trailers for YA
It was like
books.
A super produced trailer. It was awesome. Like, and they were like, the debut novel. It's like, this is a debut? Yeah. Like, they're really splashing out some cash. Yeah. It's just like, and she's not white, this is wonderful.
No, the only time I've ever seen trailers for YA novels was before The Hunger Games,
yeah.
Which is, you know, the same audience, so naturally that's before The Avengers,
it was awesome.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was really cool. And you know, and everyone was like, huh, you know, after the trailer came out, because they're like, it's a book. I remember though. And then the movie happened and I cried, but
yes, Jen's very sad about
the thing is like, I laughed while it was happening. Someone, I think it was on the Skiffy and Fanti podcast, they said it was like eating a bag of Doritos, which is ironic. I wasn't sure that he was aware of that particular reference, but he said, it's like eating a bag of Doritos, it's really enjoyable while it's happening, but afterwards you just have like cheese on your teeth and your stomach hurts. And it was like, hashtag accurate.
I haven't seen it yet, so I have no opinions about it.
Please go see it so we can talk about it.
I am planning on it. I just, the past... Every weekend since it has come out, I have been away or occupied.
Yeah.
So I'm going to have to find a time to fit it in.
You know, it's completely fine. Joss Whedon phoned it in.
Mm.
He did his thing.
That's too bad. Yeah.
Whatever, he's gone now. I don't care. Joss Whedon is dead. Long live the Russo brothers. But yeah, I think, you know, I'm sure that whenever I have a summer project, I will announce it here, and you can all keep me accountable.
Yes.
All tens of you. So we do have, I did ask briefly on Twitter about 30 minutes ago, so
we understandably
not a lot of people have.
We have a previous question.
No, I'm just talking about, I'm taking submissions of what people...
What
people read. And Emma Mills said she rereads Pride and Prejudice every summer, and also her favorite Babysitter's Club books from back in the day.
And that's, how very on topic, Emma.
Well, no, because I asked.
I know, no, but her book is... Her book is Pride and Prejudice meets Friday Night Lights.
Her book is Jane Austen meets Pride and Night
Yes,
Lights.
It's sort of a Jane Austen remix. It's not a retelling of
Remix! Thank God.
Yeah.
We've seen...
That was part of what made it so compelling to me, is that you could really see the influence of Jane Austen, but it wasn't, like, hitting all the beats of Pride and Prejudice
And you weren't
again.
Sitting there reading it, trying to figure out who was Darcy. I mean, it's obvious who was Darcy, but, like, who was, you know...
But you can't... But, like, there's nothing else.
There wasn't, like, an obvious plot that you could sort of, like, point to. Like, oh my God, this is Persuasion.
Yeah.
Well done.
Yes. That's one of the things that made it such a sort of fresh homage to me.
Homage, yes. So no one else has chimed in with what
their favorite books
for the summer.
Thanks, Emma. You're the best.
So I guess we can get to questions. I guess this is going to be kind of a short episode this week. I was hoping that you had seen Avengers so we could talk about it.
Sorry.
How dare you?
I'm just activity. Sad. We have a very old question from almost a month ago from our friend Nora McLaughlin, Nora Stories on Twitter, who asks, how much does the size of an agent's client list matter? What's the most you think you could handle?
I don't know. I always think that I will not know until I have reached the number yes. at which I cannot handle
like,
it anymore.
Oh, this is too much. Okay.
Because at any one time, not everyone is going to be writing something. Like, I'm not going to have something true. To do for everyone at every moment.
You have someone who is off writing something and you can't do anything until they finish writing it.
Yeah.
So it's just in the background.
And a lot of times, you know, agents with bigger lists who are doing really well, they've got assistants.
Yes.
And those assistants take care of a lot of stuff for them.
Yes.
So I'm not sure it really...
Yeah, it's there are things to consider, which is this is always the selling point that I try to pitch people with when I am trying to sign clients, is that if you have someone who has a very small list, they can give you a lot of personal attention. Their attention isn't distributed over all these many people. They're really focused on you.
Yeah.
And so that is part of why I have been rather selective in offering to clients, because I want to be able to give that sort of attention to people, and I don't want to just have clients to have clients. And so I'm trying to avoid hitting the maximum point
too early. That makes sense. I feel like I've got a good number right now, but yeah. I'm looking to sign more because you eventually run out of material to sell.
Yes.
So, you know.
And you need to be selling a certain amount every month in order to be able to survive on commission. So, need to ramp it up.
Way to use your words there. Yes. Yes. Okay, so we have a couple from Tumblr that have been hanging around for a little bit. So we have one question. Hi, Bridget and Jen. By no means feel the need to read my entire question on the air. Too late. I am long-winded. I am curious about audience demographics. You guys talk about a lot about YA versus NA and adult, but what are the people who buy books actually like? Are YA readers mostly tween girls, teen girls, young 20s? I'm sure that these demographics change at conferences as well, but the difference between sci-fi conference attendees and Tumblr has got to be substantial. Then again, the two of you are kind of both thoughts.
Well,
there is no answer. Yeah. The answer is 1, 2, 3. It depends. You know, not every young adult book is designed to appeal to everyone. So,
yeah.
Or to everyone, and even in that demographic. So,
they've done a lot of recent research that has revealed that many of the people buying YA books are adults. It's unclear whether they're buying them for themselves or buying them for teenagers, but there are a lot of adults who buy YA books. I sort of maintain that the adults who buy YA books are not the audience that I'm going after. I'm aiming
for... This is your whole childhood is a different thing crusade.
Yes, let stories about children be for them, and about them. But, so yeah, when I am looking at YA, I'm not looking for things that will necessarily appeal to adults who want to remember what it was like to be a teenager. I'm looking for stories that will resonate with current teenagers, and hopefully adults will also like that and buy it, because I am totally willing to take their money.
Yeah.
They're just not my focus.
Yeah. Another question about demographics from Anonymous on Tumblr. I have recently seen that some agents are looking for NA fantasy novels. Meaning
are they
new
really,
adult.
Though?
I have not seen this mythical unicorn.
Yeah.
My own protagonists are in their early 20s in the novel I'm shopping, but that goes for a lot of fantasy that's been published over the years. What distinguishes an NA fantasy novel from an adult-focused fantasy where the main character just so happens to be in their late teens to mid-20s? Romance.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Is there a lot of sex in it?
Is there a lot of sex in it? And how? I mean, the thing is, you know, new adult, so far the only thing that has actually happened in new adult is new adult romance.
Yep.
Contemporary new adult romance. I personally have not seen a lot of sort of new adult fantasy as such do well, unless I'm just missing a bunch of marketing that...
Yeah, I can't even think of any.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just adult fantasy. Your book is adult fantasy.
Yeah. Unless it's YA fantasy.
Unless it's YA fantasy with where they're boning all the time and they're actually 20.
If it is, you can send it to the people who are asking for new adult fantasy as new adult fantasy if you want. Otherwise, I would just pitch it as fantasy.
Right.
Because there's a long history in fantasy as of
younger early protagonists,
20s protagonists. Yeah. That's sort of standard. I am interested in that age group and in people who are sort of struggling with that what does it mean to be an adult question. But I'm, and in the past I have considered that new adult, but as new adult hasn't really taken off beyond contemporary romance, I'm just sort of shifting the way I think about it in my head.
Another thing that I sort of like to point out is that in a fantasy world, you get to define what age adulthood happens.
Mm-hmm.
So 20s doesn't necessarily have to be, I don't know. Does that make sense? Like, it doesn't necessarily have to be sort of that.
Yeah. Like, know, we have that historical context for 13 being an adult. So you can make it whatever you want when they're 20s.
Okay. Next question, also from Anonymous. I recently signed with an agent. Yay. We went out on submissions shortly after I signed with her, and since then there hasn't been a lot of communication. She's off doing her agent thing, and I'm working on something new. But the past couple of weeks have been rough. The new book isn't working, there's family stuff going on, day job stress, writing seems pointless. I don't want to inundate my new agent with my insecurities or be that client, but I feel like I'm drowning. Do I clue her in or no? There's a lot going on here.
Yes.
The one thing I would say is, you know, your agent cannot fix your life.
Yeah.
And before... And I don't always do the best at this, but when your agent is going out on submission, I always ask my clients, how much do you want to know?
Yeah.
And then I do my absolute best. And sometimes I fall short, but I do my absolute best to keep them informed as much as they want.
Yeah.
Meaning, when you started going out on submission, did you just tell your agent, like, oh, I just want to know if someone says no? It might take you a really long time to get that no.
Mm-hmm.
So if the only thing that your agent can control is letting you know what's going on.
Yeah.
And if they don't know that they need to keep you more informed, then they don't know.
Yeah.
So I would say that in this situation, it sounds like you need to reach out to your agent and say, hey, I thought I would be cool with this. Turns out I'm getting a little anxious. Would it be cool if you sent me, you know, updates every couple of weeks to let me know that there hasn't been any responses? But other than that, the agent can't do anything about the other stuff going on in your life.
Yeah. And if you're...
Not to sound, like, dismissive, because, like, you know, that sounds really stressful, and I'm really sorry you're having such a tough time, because, you know, writing is one of those things... Writing and publishing are one of those things where, like, when things aren't going well, it feels incredibly personal.
Yeah.
And feeds into, like, everything else going on in such a deep way.
And it's sort of like, this is such an easy thing to do, why can't I do it? And then it's like...
Putting words together, I put words together every day. All the time. All the time.
So many tweets.
So many words combined into various combinations of punctuation. So I totally get where you're coming from. But, you know, at the same time, your agent probably has other clients going on, and if they don't know that they need to do this...
Yeah.
I mean, like I said, I don't always, you know, I'm not always the most successful at this, but, like, I try.
The one thing that I would suggest is if there is something concrete that your agent can do to sort of help your fears or help your struggles, that you should let her know. If it's something like, I'm really struggling with writing this book and there's a lot of other crap going on in my life, can you take a look at these first 50 pages that I've written and tell me whether it's worth pursuing? And then your agent can look at the first 50 pages and say, yeah, you're doing a great job. I can't wait to see the rest of this. And maybe that will help you.
Or even they could say, you know, hey, I can see that this is a good beginning, but here's some ideas.
Yeah.
And sometimes just doing things in a vacuum is the hardest.
Yeah.
Like, without feedback. And I think we had a similar question last week where someone was asking, you know, how do you deal with, you know, the next book? And it sounds like this is a situation where you might want to give periodic updates to the agent to see how things are going.
Sometimes people lean on their agents to sort of be therapists. That's not really our job. We are not trained in that. but if you find that you need someone to talk to, maybe you should seek out an actual therapist, and maybe that would help.
If you know, if you're able to, you know, it's not everyone. We know what healthcare in America is like. Assuming you're in America, I don't know. It's tough because, you know, my impulse is also to, like, help, and you know. I'm not always good at helping.
Yes.
So
it's like, maybe the things that I have to suggest are not actually going to help you. Maybe they would only help me. I don't know.
Yeah. So I hope that was helpful. I mean, congratulations on signing with an agent.
Mm.
And it sounds like your book is good enough on its own that they didn't feel it needed work. I mean, I think you should feel confident that they went out on submission immediately after signing you, because that means
yeah.
that your book is strong enough that they think an editor is ready to take a look at it. So,
yeah. Make sure that if you are going to your agent with something that they need to do, it's something concrete and easily managed, and it's not just
yeah.
complaints into the void, because they're not really trained to help with that.
And I just want to say this for everyone mm-hmm. that listens to this podcast. Publishing is a waiting game.
Oh my god, yes.
For every deal that you hear about where they're like, I went on to the submission and 5 days later I got an offer.
Yeah.
There are 100 where you have to wait 6 months or more.
Yeah.
And even the most enthusiastic editor has to wait sometimes, and they yeah. have to wait to get to something that they want to read, mm-hmm. or they have to wait for someone to get back with second reads. Like, you need to have a certain amount of patience.
And the truth is...
And it's tough, because no one wants to fucking wait for an answer.
No.
Especially, like, you know, if it's an editor that already has one of your projects, or that you've already worked with. Like, it's tough. It's so fucking tough. But, like, there's literally nothing that your agent could do about it. Yeah.
And the truth is that as long as there is no news, there is hope.
Yes. Yes.
No news means it's not a no. Yeah. And sometimes it means that they liked it enough that they really need to seriously consider it.
Yeah.
And get second reads and that yeah. sort of thing. So as long as, honestly, not hearing anything is often good news in publishing.
What was it? I remember one of the brief considerations for a title for this podcast was a faster no.
Yes.
And I still think that that's actually a pretty good phrase of how, like, the hurry up and wait thing can really fuck you. Because, yeah. like, if you hurry someone, they will give you a no just out of...
Just because, like, that's the easiest answer to give. That's the
easiest answer, yeah. It's like, this is annoying enough to me now that I don't want to deal with it.
Yeah.
Okay, so moving on to the next question. Also, Anonymous asks, possibly different Anonymous, I don't know. The Tumblr icon for Anonymous is a little circle wearing some cool shades. I appreciate that. I really... really, really, really want to work with a book packager. I know the pay is often not the best and that I would retain few rights and could make even fewer creative decisions. But most of the book I love growing up were package books, and it's crazy how much I want to play in that sandbox. I've sent in a few applications and heard back that I was placed on a few lists, but then nothing. How does one break in with packaging? That's a good question. I've actually never... The people that I've met with, the editors that I've worked with that either develop IP in-house or that work with packagers, you know, they'll occasionally send out projects that I will put my authors forward for.
Mm-hmm.
But so far we haven't landed on a project that has actually worked.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like you just need to keep trying. And it also yeah. might help if you have ideas that are not in a sandbox. You know, if yeah. you are able to get an agent for that, you know, they may have connections to get you in a little faster. I mean, it's good that you know the limitations of packagers, like, yes. up front. It's like, oh, good, you've already brought up all my objections.
Yeah, this actually, you are way ahead of the pack because you clearly know exactly what you get out of packaging and why you want to do it. And I think that those are good reasons. If it's something that, if you want to do it because you enjoy the possibilities of it and the actual products that come out
of it. And don't mind if your name get changed or if you aren't allowed to write the sequels.
You don't get the copyright.
Or get any money.
As long as you know all of that going in, then it can be a great way to do some writing. But the other thing I would recommend is just keep writing your own stuff. If you can write short stories, that sort of thing, get some credentials, just sort of work on building your own platform, I guess.
From what I understand from a lot of from people that I've talked to, is that people, you know, editors and packagers, they want someone who is able to create a unique voice,
mm-hmm.
but not so unique that someone reading it could immediately identify it as an individual person's.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So it's not like, this is clearly a John Green book. Like, you know, it's clearly like a book in the Vampire Diaries world.
Yeah.
I mean, is spec script a thing in the packaging world? Like, I don't know if that's...
I don't know. I'm just thinking that if you have some credentials, it might make you stand out a little bit more.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
In the application process.
That's tough is that, you know, a lot of the packagers that I know do YA, and there isn't exactly like a burgeoning short market in YA
to
like work on.
The other thing to do is Kindle Worlds.
Yes, Kindle Worlds.
You can write stuff in that market and sort of get sort of dip a toe in, do your own thing, do what you want, and then when that's a way to sort of prove to potential packagers that you are able to write in someone else's world and you've already done it. And
yeah,
here are some of your things. And also, from what I understand, you make some money in Kindle Worlds as the writer.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it's a little bit more impressive to them, I bet, than fan fiction would be.
Well, and fan fiction is never, it's like a completely different animal. I mean, I feel like the vibe and the tone of fan fiction, like even terrible fan fiction, is often so different from like the actual canon thing.
Yes, that's
that
true.
It, you know, demonstrating that you're good at fan fiction doesn't necessarily demonstrate that you're good at writing
yeah.
a canon, like approved world.
That's true.
Entry.
So
one of the reasons I love fandom is because it doesn't make any have any connection to
yes.
the original thing. It's like, oh, that thing, let me make that thing better.
Yes.
Often they don't want you to make it better.
No.
They want you to make it the same.
Yes. They want you to write the thing that sells and makes the money. But yeah, so that's Kindle Worlds is an option for you to explore.
We have another question from another anonymous. I've noticed a lot of agents don't deal with category romance, but it seems like the category authors who have agents get a better deal. How do you get an agent with a category romance if most agents don't represent it? And why do so few agents represent it? My friends who write category are killing it in sales, but they can't seem to get any agent interest. I don't read category romance. That's one of the reasons I don't. I mean, I read a lot of single title stuff.
Mm.
So that's the reason why I don't represent it.
I don't really read romance novels. So yeah.
I'm sorry we can't be more helpful. I mean, I would be very interested to, if anyone has, you know, any sort of, like, anecdotal or otherwise evidence of, you know, how well their sales are. I mean, I don't know the answer to this question because I don't read category romance, and I think that also might just be, like, a cultural kind of shift. Like, a lot of the agents I know are younger, and the agents I know that read romance don't necessarily read category.
Yeah.
They read single title. They, you know, they have authors that they love,
mm-hmm.
and not necessarily like buying all the Harlequin Blaze novels. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I don't read romance novels just like as a genre, so I hardly know the difference.
Another thing too is, you know, when you're querying a category romance, especially if you're an author that has had success in category romance, success is success.
Yeah,
and you know, when you're querying a work, you can say like, "Hi, I'm an author with, you know, 10 books titled with Harlequin Love Inspired.
Mm-hmm.
These books have sold over X amount of copies each. I would like to get an agent to negotiate. I'm coming up on my contract renewal, and I would like to get an agent for these books. Here's my latest project."
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the other thing. Don't just present yourself as a category romance author. Present the information of how many have you sold?
Yes.
How, you know, how many books have you done? How many, you know, copies have each of those sold? That's information that an agent wants.
Yeah.
If you just say, like, I write category romance without giving any other information, it's like, okay, well, what does that mean?
Yeah. And the one thing I might suggest, you know, with grain of salt, because I don't really deal with this genre at all, but if you write something that doesn't quite fit into the, like, if you're writing single title or something that an agent can really sell on its own that isn't quite in this category, that might help. You give them a new project that they can run with, and they will also handle your category contracts.
Mm-hmm.
That's a suggestion. I don't know if that is necessarily going to work for you, but it's sort of like self-publishing. I can't help you if you've already self-published something, but if you come to me with a new project.
Yeah, and this goes for a lot of things. I mean, I have heard from many different agents, someone coming to them, I have gotten a contract with X big publisher.
Yeah.
Will you represent me? And I'm like, have you signed the contract? Have you accepted the contract? I cannot do anything for you.
Yeah.
So then it becomes a less attractive prospect when someone has gone ahead and, like, accepted a bunch of terms that, like, you know, you never would have agreed to.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, I'm not even making any money off this, so.
Yeah. And if it's something that I would have liked to represent anyway, I would have liked to try to sell it to a bigger publisher.
Yeah.
One that probably doesn't accept unagented submissions.
Yes. 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 Okay. So we have one more question. I've noticed agents selling books to royalty-only publishers, often in SFF, and I'm wondering if the book with no advance is sort of the mid-list of the future. Mm-hmm. And in a related question, if you're... Well, okay. Mid-list of the future. Let's deal with that first.
Oh, dear.
I don't know if that's the Middle-East of the future. I think that a bunch of places are trying it out.
Yeah.
And we're all just sort of waiting to see how it goes.
Yeah. And it sort of also needs to have very high royalty rates to make that worthwhile.
Yes. And it's tough because I know several publishers and several editors that I would love to work with. But if I'm faced with a print offer with sort of even a more traditional royalty structure, but if it's a print offer
with an advance,
that to me is probably for the foreseeable future going to be a little bit more attractive.
Especially since when you know they're putting money behind it and they're printing it and they're giving you money, you suspect that they're also going to do more marketing for it.
I mean, it's tough because like I know that's not necessarily true of a lot of the places that do the digital first. Mm. Like I know that Harper Voyager busts their butts for their SFF authors that they do, but you know it's also hard to present that to your author as like an option. You know, it's like, oh, they don't want to give you any money, but they're going to work real hard for you.
Yeah,
the cash on the barrelhead thing is a very powerful inducement.
Yeah,
and I think you know I don't know.
I can see.
The world in which I would sell a book to a digital first SFF publisher. I don't think that day is far off. I mean, I think though that a lot of times, and it's definitely not like bad faith. It's definitely like we're genuinely trying to take a chance on, you know, some weirder books or some books that don't necessarily fall into a category.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, you want them to take that leap with you.
Yeah. A lot.
Which is really tough. 'Cause like, I understand like, Lord, I understand this industry is kind of on fire, like, all the time, yes. So, like, you just don't have the money sometimes.
Fires.
Just permanent. Oh. It's like that, have you ever seen that comic where it's, like, the dog sitting in the room that's, like, on, like, it's, like, sitting at a table, like, drinking tea and everything is on fire? He's like, yes, this is fine. This is fine. It's publishing all the time.
Yep. Even down to the T. A lot of my taste in everything, including SFF, runs a little bit more towards the literary side than the commercial side. And I know that does not tend to do quite as well in digital.
Yeah.
And so for me, it's going to be a little bit more difficult.
Yeah.
Just based on the things that I like, I think that they need to be in print in order to sell.
Yeah.
And so it's...
Here's a question. Do you think that Ancillary Justice would have done as well if it had been digital first?
No, and that's also an interesting one because it was paperback. They did not have a hardcover release.
Yeah.
I
think that actually had a lot to do with it because I think that there is that sort of I think that in a lot of people's minds, and I don't think that they're always correct, I think that there is a mental correlation between in SFF specifically between the way it is first published and the relative quality.
Yes.
And I don't think that that's true for most of there's a lot of shit hardcover.
Yeah.
There's a lot of shit mass market. There's a lot of shit, you know, trade paperback original. There's a lot of shit ebooks.
Yeah.
So, but I think that in SFF, which is still a pretty hidebound, pretty conservative market, I mean, the ebooks that I have seen do gangbusters are romance.
Yes.
Because those people are hungry for content. Those readers are hungry.
They will try anything.
3 a week, at least. Yep. You know, that's the reading rate. But you don't see that kind of readership in SFF.
No, and
the books are longer. The books are
I was
denser.
Gonna say,
the plots aren't
they take
as
take a little bit longer to get through.
Yeah, because they're not. You know, you're not banking on the on the sort of like tried and true emotional beats.
Yeah.
So it's, basically, it depends.
It's
we're changing the name of the podcast. It depends.
It depends.
In a related question, if you're a writer who has published with a small publisher like Entangled or Curiosity Quills, and you're still looking to sign with an agent, what are some strategies for the query trenches of the next book? And I don't mean a sequel. I hope your book is sold well.
Yep. Also, Entangled, I hope your next book is freaking awesome.
The thing about presses is specifically in SFF, it depends on the press and it depends on the book. But no matter what, no matter who you're publishing with, if you're looking for your second book, they're going to look at your sales.
Yep.
And sometimes smaller presses can't really muster up the sales numbers, just because, you know, they're smaller, they don't have necessarily the marketing budget.
Sometimes
Entangled does really great work.
They do.
And I think that the important thing to think about when you're querying, if this is not your debut, is you need to be able to point to some good sales numbers.
Yeah.
Not, like, set the world on fire sales numbers, but you need to be able to demonstrate that you sold, like, at least 1,000 copies.
Often with the small presses like that, the threshold is lower. You don't need to have sold as many copies with Entangled as you would have with HarperCollins, in order to prove that you're sort of a worthwhile investment. Because if you can sell that many copies with a small publisher that doesn't have much reach, then what can they do with you as a big publisher with a lot of marketing money? And so that is actually something that can work in your favor working with the small press. Before you go back into the query trenches, I would hustle a little bit and make sure you have sold enough copies, and also make sure your next book is really, really good. If people can't tell you no, that is always a good place to be standing.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's tough because, I mean, I feel like in this conversation we've been sort of shitting a little bit on small presses, and that's absolutely not our intention.
No,
it's just really tough because your first book is so important.
Yes.
It makes a huge difference who you're published by and how you get published the first time.
Especially in a market like this that's so crowded and it's so hard to sell anything in this market.
I mean, we were just talking earlier about the YA market and how it's on fire and not in a good way, you know, when it's tough. It really depends on what book you're shopping to, because a lot of times, you know, getting a book placed in like a smaller press is a really great stepping stone because, I mean, I think in any case, getting a book placed with a small press is a good thing because somewhat, depending on the small press, because it means that someone has taken a chance on your work. One of the great things about getting an offer, you know, on your debut from a small press is that, you know, it shows that someone has taken a look at your work and has, you know, decided that they want to commit resources to it. Mm-hmm. But for me, too, when I see someone that said my first book was published by a small press and they don't already have an agent, that sets off alarm bells to me because it says that you didn't care enough the first time to find an agent or you couldn't find an agent the first time, which is entirely possible. You know, it may not have connected with the agents you were talking to. But when I see I did a deal without an agent, that's like a red flag for me.
It makes me a little bit nervous. It also may just have been sort of a weird book that you struggled to place, and I've signed a few weird books in my time, so that may not actually be a problem, but it's a hurdle that you're sort of putting up for yourself.
Yeah.
Unless, of course, if you can demonstrate a strong track record and good sales, then that's a plus.
Yeah, if you can, I mean, for all of these questions, the answer is if your sales are good, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Because if you have demonstrated that readers are into your work, then it does not matter who published you.
Yep.
And, I mean, I think the same goes for self-publishing. If you can demonstrate a strong sales track that's not free.
Yes.
Then
that's the difference. if you're giving it away and you have lots of numbers, that's not impressive.
That doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
Well, I think that is reaching the end of the questions that we have for today. Emma Mills did ask a question, what do you look for in a beach read? But I feel like we already answered that.
I think we did.
So let's move on to what we're reading right now.
Well, I am currently in the second round of my Tamara Pierce reread book club. So I just finished rereading Emperor Mage. I'm really upset because I can't get into that romance anymore. I can't get past the fact that Numera is my age and Dane is 15. I can't do it anymore. I'm really upset because I really liked that romance when I was a teenager.
Womp womp.
And so it's disappointing. But I still really like the books. I need to read the fourth one. I don't own it, and there are holds on it at the library, and I'm not 100% sure how I'm going to get a hold of it before Wednesday. Womp. So I'm sort of on hold at that one. I also just started reading The Five Stages of Andrew Brawley.
Oh, yes.
By Sean Hutchinson.
Represented by my coworker, Amy Boggs.
And Amy loaned me the book, and so I'm supposed to pass it around, as you did with First and Then.
Emily's coming by to get it. She was like, oh, we should hang out this week. Also, do you have First and Then? I was like, I see what's happening here. You don't actually want to hang out with me.
I just want everyone to read the book and love it. That's all. I have very low aspirations.
Yeah.
And so I just started that last night. So I'm like 30 pages in. I don't really have a picture of it yet. But, you know, it seems good so far. So
cool.
Yeah.
Well, I am currently reading. So a couple of weeks ago, I finished Dreadnought which was mm-hmm. the book about the naval arms race between Britain and Germany in the run-up to World War One, because I'm going to die alone. and then last week when I was at Barnes & Noble and I, you know, was looking at stuff, I discovered that it had a sequel called Castles of Steel about naval war, the Great War at Sea. And it's sort of suffering from the thing that I really hate about military history in general, which is like, and then this boat fought this boat at this time, and these people died, and I was just like, I don't care. Except I did learn that for a long time, I think the second sea lord in England was this guy named Prince Louis of Battenberg, who was born in Germany.
Yes, I was going to say, I'm pretty sure Battenberg is
in Germany. Yeah, no, he was definitely born in Germany, and his family would sort of like, you know, keep going to Germany for vacations, even when people are like, maybe you shouldn't, because people super hate the Germans right now. and it was mid-World War One that all the names got changed to, like, Mountbatten and things like that. Mm. And Prince Louis of Battenberg is from, like, the weird sort of, they call it the Morganatic arm, because he married someone that wasn't, like, royal. So, anyway, so Prince Charles is his descendant.
Oh.
So, if Prince Charles becomes king, then, like, the Battenbergs will have succeeded in becoming royal once again. And if you really care about royalty, which I am increasingly discovering that I just really super don't, then that would be interesting. But, I mean, so that one's, Robert K. Massey is amazing. He's just really a great writer. Mm. But I ordered two books this week that I'm hoping to get soon. One was The Ember in the Ashes by mm-hmm. Saba Tahir, and then one that I thought that Amy had left behind, but which she took with her to Spain, and which had to order, which is Renee Adier's The Wrath and the Dawn, which has the most beautiful cover I've seen on anything.
Really,
so
great.
Those are coming. They are supposed to be delivered very soon, and then I will be reading them.
I may borrow some of those.
Yes, from you. You are allowed.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Marvelous. Alrighty, well, I don't think we have any other questions.
I think we're also out of time.
Cool. Well, thank you again for listening. As always, you can submit questions to us via Twitter at Ship and Handling, via our email address at shippingandhandlingpodcast@gmail.com, or via our Ask box on Tumblr, and you can ask things anonymously, and you can mm-hmm. make suggestions and give feedback. Shout out to that person who let me know that there were two episode 14s. I appreciate that. and it's now fixed. And
we're super good at counting.
We're good agents. Good at our jobs. And on that note, thank you for listening. Bye.